This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's impossible to understand the current crisis between Israelis and Palestinians without a grasp of history. Today we're going to examine one chapter in the complicated history of the region, the Old City of Jerusalem and its holy sites. Jurisdiction over these sites remains one of the contested issues between Israelis and Palestinians. In fact, one of the incidents that led to the current crisis was when Ariel Sharon, the Israeli hardliner and former defense minister, asserted Jewish claims to the Temple Mount, a Jewish holy site that is also a Muslim holy site known as Haram al-Sharif. My guest Karen Armstrong is a scholar of the world's religions. She's the author of Jerusalem, One City, Three Faiths, as well as the bestseller, A History of God. Her latest book is called Islam, A Short History. She's a former nun. I asked Armstrong to describe the importance of the Temple Mount and Haram al-Sharif to the Jews and Muslims who worship there.
The Temple Mount is the holiest place in the Jewish world, and every day worshippers will go there. People who live in Jerusalem will pray there at the Western Wall, the last link with Herod's Temple. They'll also celebrate marriage there. They'll celebrate the bar mitzvah of their sons. And it's the hub of Jewish religious life in Jerusalem. But up above it, you have the Haram al-Sharif, the third holiest shrine in the Muslim world. And there you have every Friday, the inhabitants of Jerusalem and the surrounding countryside will gather for the Friday prayers to hear a sermon and to pray together as a community. They'll visit the Dome of the Rock, the oldest great building in the Muslim world, the site of the Prophet Muhammad's ascension to heaven. And that is a site of pilgrimage for Muslims all over the world. And that's very much the hub of Muslim religious life in Jerusalem. Muslims will gather there to pray together, to discuss, to study. It's the center of their religious lives in Jerusalem.
Let's go back to the origins of the Jewish temple. When was it first built?
Well, the Bible tells us that King Solomon built a temple around about 950 BC. And this was the temple to his God, Yahweh. And it was a shrine of great importance to the people of Israel. His father, King David, had conquered the city from the inhabitants, the Jebusites, some 50 years earlier. And now Jerusalem was brought into the Israelite religious world, and it became gradually, over the centuries, a very important shrine for the people of Israel.
And how was it destroyed?
Well, it was destroyed a couple of times. It was destroyed in 586 by King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon, during the course of hostilities against the people of Judah. And then the Jews later rebuilt their temple. And eventually that one was destroyed by the Romans in the Jewish revolt against Rome in the year 70. And Jews mourned the loss of that temple, but created a new form, new ways of being Jewish.
Now, how did this area become both an Islamic holy site and a Jewish holy site?
Well, the Muslims had always venerated Jerusalem. As soon as the Prophet Muhammad began to preach in Mecca in the year 610, he made his followers bow down in worship several times a day, facing Jerusalem, in the direction of Jerusalem. It was their way of turning their backs on the pagan traditions of Mecca and reaching out to the God of the Jews and the Christians, whom they were now going to worship. Islam, especially at the beginning, did not regard itself as a new faith. Muhammad simply felt that he was bringing the old faith of the Jews and the Christians, the one God, to the people of Arabia, who'd never had a prophet before and had never had a scripture in their own language. And so the Quran venerates all the great prophets of the Jewish Christian past. And the Quran remembers with great piety the story of Solomon, the prophet Solomon, who built a temple in Jerusalem. And so when the Muslims arrived in Jerusalem and conquered the city in the year 638, they immediately made a beeline for the Temple Mount, and there they established themselves on the site of the great prophets of the past, as well as celebrating the Prophet Muhammad and his mystical journey to heaven on the Temple Mount. They also venerate Solomon and King David and Jesus, who plays a very important role in the Islamic devotion to Jerusalem.
What shape was the temple in when the Muslims took over that area and rebuilt the temple?
Well, the Christians, who had been in charge of the city, had left the Temple Mount in a state of ruin. It was a mark of disrespect to Judaism. The place was piled high with rubble and fallen masonry. And in recent years, shortly before the Muslim conquest, the Christians had taken to using the site as the city garbage dump. And so it was piled high with stinking garbage and rubbish. And the caliph and his entourage were absolutely horrified when they arrived on the Temple Mount and saw this scene of absolute desolation. And immediately the caliph began to take stones and rubbish into his cloak and then hurl it over the parapets, clearing the site. So the Muslims consecrated the site and built, first of all, a very simple little mosque at the southern end of the platform. And that's the site on which the mosque known as Al-Aqsa stands today. Later, in the year 691, they built the famous Dome of the Rock, which is the shrine with the great golden dome that's so famous and so clearly associated with Jerusalem today.
When the Muslims reconsecrated the area that had been the Jewish temple, did they welcome Jews to that area to pray?
Yes, indeed. The Christians had never permitted Jews to reside permanently in the city. But the caliph and the Muslims brought Jews back. 70 families from Tiberias up in the north of Israel were brought back into Jerusalem, and they settled down. And Jews, they didn't want to build a temple of their own, of course, on the Temple Mount. The rabbis had told them that only the Messiah could build a third temple. That would be at the end of days. It wasn't for mere men to do that. But they really celebrated the reconsecration of the site by the Muslims. And there are texts in the 7th century which show Jews welcoming the Muslims and celebrating them as the precursors of the Messiah for this act of piety in rededicating their holy site.
How long did these good feelings between Jews and Muslims last in Jerusalem?
Good feelings between Jews and Muslims lasted a very, very long time, up to the beginning of the 20th century. There was tension between the Muslims and the Christians, especially after the Crusades. The Crusades marked the real nadir of life in Jerusalem. It was a horrible, devastating attack by the Western Christians of Europe, and many, many Jews and Muslims died in Jerusalem as the victims of the Crusaders. But relations between Judaism and Islam in the Middle East and in Jerusalem were generally good, that's why the present conflict is so particularly tragic.
My guest is religion scholar Karen Armstrong. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're talking about some of the ancient history that might help us understand the current events in the Middle East and the crisis between Israel and the Palestinians. My guest is a scholar of religion, Karen Armstrong, whose books include Jerusalem and Islam, A Short History. She's also written about the history of fundamentalism around the world. Let's jump ahead to more contemporary history, more recent history. The British captured Jerusalem in 1917, thank you.
Yes.
Why did the Brits want that part of the world? What were they doing there?
Oh, well, the British at that time were fighting World War One, and one of the enemies that they were fighting in World One was the Ottoman Empire, the Turkish Empire, and which had sided with Germany. And so they were invading the lands of the Ottoman Empire right across the Middle East, Syria, Palestine, Lebanon, and Egypt, where they were already had a military occupation. But of course, once the war was over, the British did not go home. It was part of their colonial mentality. Britain at that stage felt that it should rule the waves. Britain and France in 1920 virtually carved up the Middle East between them and established protectorates there. They felt that they were a civilizing force in the region, but this was, of course, much resented by the Arab peoples of the area who'd all hoped for independence once the Ottoman Empire had been defeated.
And how did the Zionists establish a foothold in that area during the British mandate?
Well, in 1917, the British government issued what's known as the Balfour Declaration, which gave British support to the idea of a Jewish homeland in Palestine. And so while the British were in charge in Jerusalem and in Palestine, they were supporting the idea of a Jewish state or a Jewish homeland, though there was much debate about how that was going to be implemented. But I'm afraid, and this saddens me to say this, the British behaviour was not good in Jerusalem. I mean, in a sense, as colonialists, they tended to despise both sides, treated both sides with a certain amount of contempt. And it's very marked when you go to Jerusalem as a Brit today that the hostility is still there on both sides, but neither the Jewish side nor the Palestinian side have much good to say about our rule in Jerusalem, which was racist and colonial and imperialistic.
And do you think that imperialistic British rule helped set the tone for what happened later?
Well, it was a very ugly struggle because it was one thing for the British government to say, oh, yes, by all means, let's have a Jewish state in Palestine or a Jewish homeland in Palestine. But then when they were actually there and saw that the place was filled with Palestinian inhabitants, then they realised that it wasn't quite so easy to implement this. And so they adopted all kinds of policies, blocking immigration, even shamefully, during the time when Jews were trying to escape from Nazi Germany before the Holocaust. So there was bad feeling there. The Arabs naturally distrusted and hated the British for giving away their land. But I think basically what you just had was a clash of two peoples who both felt that they had a claim to the land. And that clash is still not resolved today.
Let's jump ahead to 1947, the UN partition. What happened to Jerusalem in 1947?
Well, in the UN plan, the idea was that Palestine should be divided between the Palestinians and the Israelis, but that Jerusalem should be a separate body, a separate entity ruled by the international community. It should be an international zone. But that plan fell by the wayside when, during the war between the new Jewish state and the invading Arab armies in 1948, in the course of which Jordan invaded East Jerusalem and Israel invaded and captured West Jerusalem, and between them, Jordan and Israel divided the city between them in a partition. It was a very ugly state of affairs. There was barbed wire dividing the two sectors of the city. Jews were not allowed to visit the Western Wall, which was in the Jordanian side, they complained that the bad feeling following the Palestinian loss of their homeland. They claimed that holy synagogues in the old city of Jerusalem were desecrated by the Palestinians. And similarly, Palestinians complained that many of their their homes in West Jerusalem had been purloined by the Israelis. So you have the beginnings of the conflict about Jerusalem, about who owned it, owns it, and what should be done with it.
I'm going to jump ahead again now to 1967 at the end of the Six-Day War. How has the status of Jerusalem changed by that?
Well, during the Six-Day War in 1967, Israel achieved a stunning victory over the invading armies and entered and occupied East Jerusalem. And Jerusalem, they said, was now united again after this period of partition. And it was a great and sort of emotional moment because Jews were able to visit the Western Wall again. And there were huge scenes of rejoicing. People who had no religious beliefs, generals like Moshe Dayan, who was not a religious man at all, had tears pouring down their faces. It was a huge thing. Largely, I think, because the Jews recognized the Western Wall as being rather like themselves, a survivor. It was linked with tradition, with some of the most sacred traditions of their past, but it was a survivor, just as they had survived some of them had survived the terrible events in Europe during World War II. The Western Wall, had survived nearly 2,000 years of bloody and turbulent history in Jerusalem. And it was an immensely important and moving moment. And from that moment, too, a new religious element entered the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Because of the holy sites. And there was, too, a religious revival on both sides of the conflict. There was a religious revival within Israel, and religious parties came more and more to the fore. A religious a form of Zionism was established. Zionism had begun as a secularist movement, almost as a revolution against religious Judaism. But now, in the new religious climate after 1967, there was a sort of a new form of religious Zionist fundamentalism. On the Muslim side, not just on the Palestinian side, but in countries such as Egypt, Jordan, there was also a religious revival. People felt that the ideologies of socialism and nationalism, which had been imported by the West, had been discredited. The Arabs had lost, suffered a shameful defeat. They seemed unable to make any headway against Israel. And people turned back to religion. They said, let's go back to the time before the West invaded our lands with all these new ideas like nationalism and socialism. Let's go back to Islam, which is back to our roots. And so from that time, a religious dimension has entered the conflict, which makes it all much more difficult to sort out. When there are simply secularist ideals, then people can feel free to make concessions, to make compromises. But when something is regarded as sacred, as absolutely essential and central to a people's identity, then it becomes much more difficult. And Jerusalem has become, for both sides of the conflict, a symbol of that sacred identity. And no compromise at the moment seems to be possible.
Now, you mentioned that Zionism started as a secular movement, and you quote Theodor Herzl, one of the fathers of Zionism, as saying in 1898, when he first visited Jerusalem, that he deplored the city's, quote, musty deposits of 2,000 years of inhumanity, intolerance, and foulness.
Yeah.
And you say his first impulse was to tear down the old city. He was just so wanted to distance himself and Zionism from the warring over it.
Well, Herzl was a secularist, and he had very little, I think, understanding of religion. He quite rightly sensed that there was going to be an impending anti-Semitic disaster in Europe. He sensed the coming Holocaust and felt that it was essential that Jews had a place of refuge. But as for the holy aspects of Jerusalem, he wasn't interested in that at all. Many of the Zionists hated watching Jews praying at the Western Wall. They hated watching these rabbis with long beards and archaic clothes clutching at these holy stones and kissing them and weeping. They said, this is an image of the old Jew. This is an image of the defeated hated, craven Jew. This is the image of everything we want Zionism to transcend. We want to create a new, proud, secular Jew. And so Herzl, when he saw all this, he said, oh, let's get rid of it. But then the next day in his diary, he changed his mind and he wrote down that he decided, let's put all the shrines in the old city, put them in a sort of separate cordon sanitaire. Let's make them into a sort of museum. And let's build outside the walls a new Zionist, modern, fresh, tolerant, bright and airy city, and get rid of the past, because we're branching out towards something new. So that was the very much the spirit. The Zionists were willing, right up to 1947, 1948, to make concessions about Jerusalem. What their priority was, getting a Jewish state working and a viable entity. Jerusalem was something that, you know, that they were willing to share it, divide it with Jordan. They agreed to the United Nations plan to make it an international zone in 1947, because the priority was to get a Jewish state, especially after World War II, when so many Jews had died in Europe. And had there been a Jewish state, perhaps they need not have died.
Karen Armstrong is the author of Jerusalem, One City, Three Faiths, and A History of God. Her latest book is called Islam, A Short History. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with religion scholar Karen Armstrong. To better understand the current Israeli-Palestinian crisis, we're examining some of the ancient and recent history of Jerusalem and its holy sites. Armstrong is the author of Jerusalem, One City, Three Faiths, and the bestseller A History of God. How is Jerusalem divided now?
Well, of course, the city is technically united under Israeli sovereignty. But there are areas in East Jerusalem where Jews don't feel comfortable about going, because these are Arab sectors, the Arab neighbourhoods. And especially in times of political crisis, tension runs high in these areas. And similarly, many Palestinians don't feel at all comfortable about going into West Jerusalem, which is predominantly an Israeli zone. And there are very, so you have, in a sense, a city that is technically at one, but still there are lines of demarcation. There are also the Israeli government has established settlements in Arab East Jerusalem, there are new Jewish neighbourhoods in what Arabs feel is their land, is their part of Jerusalem, and that is also the source of a great deal of tension.
What do the Palestinians want now for Jerusalem?
They want a share in sovereignty. Then they are not, except for their extreme hotheads, they are not claiming sole sovereignty over the entire city. But they do want a sovereignty in part of the city. They want to share the city in a sort of an official way with the Israelis. The Israelis, however, say that Jerusalem is the eternal and indivisible capital of the state of Israel, and say they must have sole sovereignty. So there is a tension here. Of course, Jerusalem has always become, in its past, more sacred and more important to a people after they've lost it. You see that phenomenon happening again and again throughout the long, troubled history of Jerusalem. When a people have been exiled from Jerusalem, have lost sovereignty of the city, they return and they say, we'll never leave this city again, and it becomes precious to them. Now, we have the Israelis, Jewish people now again in charge of Jerusalem for the first time for nearly 2,000 years, after periods of tremendous suffering in Jewish life. Some see the Jewish Jerusalem as arising like a phoenix out of the ashes of Auschwitz. It's seen as it's one way in which the Jewish people feel that they can perhaps begin to come to terms with the Holocaust. But on the other hand, the Palestinians watch the city slipping daily from their grasp, and they feel more passionate about it than ever. They see the city, surrounded as it is by these big, powerful Jewish neighbourhoods, as a symbol of their own beleaguered identity. Both of them, you have a clash here of two people who have either just returned to Jerusalem or feel that they are losing it, and are both feeling more passionate about it than ever. So, you know, that makes the whole thing very inflammatory and very sensitive. And holy sites are likely to be particular flashpoints.
Now, you are a scholar of the religions of the world. And you worship in all three of the monotheistic religions. You go to churches, you go to mosques, you go to synagogues. As somebody who embraces all three faiths, and I should mention here that you used to be a nun, that you were brought up Catholic, do you feel like you empathize with both the Israelis and the Palestinians?
Yes, I can see both where they're coming from. I really can. I can see that after the Holocaust, the Jewish people is still profoundly wounded, and its attachment to Jerusalem is understandable. But I can also understand the Palestinians, who have always loved Jerusalem, who the Muslim world looked after Jerusalem and allowed Jews always to come and live in the city when they were in charge of it. I sympathize with them too, because it's not just the holy sites or the holiness of the city. Jerusalem is the home of Palestinians. Their families have lived in the city for generations. They feel about Jerusalem, apart from its being a holy city, as we all feel about our hometowns. There is an attachment there, to people who've both been wounded in very different ways and to different degrees, but have been wounded. I hate seeing this bloodshed, which I see as tragic for both sides. Tragic for the Palestinians. Most of the loss of life has been Palestinian. But I also grieve for the Israeli army, which was a magnificent achievement, and which is, in a sense, almost, I feel, wounding itself by gunning down children and civilians. This is a terrible, terrible situation, and I feel really quite torn by watching this. My own religious journey was strongly shaped by Jerusalem. I was sick and tired of religion when I first visited Jerusalem in 1983. But it was the vision of these three faiths living together, however uneasily, in this holy city, which made me profoundly aware of the interconnection, the link between these three religions of Abraham. And from that time on, I've always tried to devote myself to presenting the three viewpoints simultaneously, seeing them as the same religious family. And it is tragic now, after it gave me that plural vision, to see the city as so often in its turbulent history, a city not of peace, but a city of bloodshed and war.
One of the things you say in your book, Jerusalem, is that the history of Jerusalem proves that suffering doesn't necessarily make us better, nobler people.
That, I think, is again true, and you see it on both sides of the conflict. It's a sort of myth, isn't it, that when we've suffered, we'll become wiser and more sympathetic and be able to empathise with the suffering of others. But it doesn't. It's very often the bully, perhaps child who's been bullied in the playground, learns to bully other people. And on both sides, the Israelis, who have the triumph, and they are powerful and have achieved enormous power and success in the state of Israel, but that sometimes they seem to be acting in a way that's disproportionate to the violence offered to them. And the Palestinians, sometimes the sort of ugliness of defeat, the corrosive effect of prolonged defeat on the spirit, is also terrible. I sympathise with them, because nobody cares about the Palestinians, not we in the West, not their own Arab neighbours. And I think they feel this, and hence this, the awful, nihilistic and dreadful prospect of more suicide bombings. I can't imagine an expression of greater despair and hopelessness than that.
Would you want to go to Jerusalem now?
Oh, yes. In fact, I was scheduled to be going to Jerusalem in December for a conference on the future of the city. Goodness knows whether that conference will be cancelled in the light of the present crisis. Probably it will. But no, you can't. It's not just a holiday place. I think if you really love a city, then you have to be there in its hard times as well as in its happier times.
Karen Armstrong is the author of Jerusalem, One City, Three Faiths, and the bestseller A History of God. Her latest book is called Islam, A Short History. Coming up, satirist Christopher Buckley on the presidential campaign. This is Fresh Air.